at him. But I suppose losing a little bit of sleep at night is a small price to pay for getting to spend my days with the finest man in the entire Roman Empire. Listen to me. I sound like a lovesick girl, when clearly my girlhood was lost long ago in the ancient mists of time. But I can't help myself. I still can't believe I'm married to a man like Gratian. He is so different from my first husband. I despised him. He was a miserable man and cruel even before he joined the Legion, and life in the Augustan cohort did not soften him. You don't rise through the ranks. You don't gain command of a centurion of soldiers if you're soft. Do you know how many hobnails there are on the sole of a Roman soldier's boot? I do. I felt every one of them. Every time I made the fish too salty or the beer too weak, every time I failed to follow an order fast enough, every time I gave birth to another girl child. What a joke his name was. Can you imagine a brutal legionnaire called Pleasant? That's right. My first husband was also Gratian. But then, Gratian was also my first husband. You look confused. So was I. Perhaps I should start at the beginning. I was married to the first Gratian for 23 years, 4 months, and 11 days, and I hated him for all but the first quarter hour. I would have hated him longer, but it took a few minutes to get to know him. He had come to my father's house to collect a gambling debt, and I was the payment. There was no wedding, of course. I got no saffron veil, no myrtle wreath, no ring. Roman soldiers aren't supposed to marry, but it doesn't stop them from having families. Under Roman law, after a year under the same roof, I was his wife, though he never called me that. I was never anything more to him than a servee, a slave. Sort of a tool that could talk if he gave it permission. I lived in fear of him. I tried to cook well enough to please him, to keep things clean enough, to stay quiet enough, but it was never enough. Every chance I got, I went to the temple of Diana, pleading with her to give me a male child, because I thought that maybe if I gave Gratian a son, he would treat me like a real wife. I prayed to every goddess of childbirth I could think of, Diana, Bona Dea, Portula, Ops, Quirites. I bribed their priests, I did penances, I would break the ice on the river on a winter's morning, and then crawl all the way back to the temple on bleeding knees. But every time it was a daughter, and every time he told the midwife to throw it on the dung heap. And I began to wish that he were dead instead of my children. I began to pray to Mithra, goddess protector of soldiers, that she would make an exception in his case. Then one day, he came home in an exceptionally foul mood, which was saying much, because he had been in an exceptionally foul mood ever since he had been transferred to Judea, the stinking armpit of the Roman Empire, a province so unimportant that the governor didn't even need to come from the senatorial families. Equestrian rank was good enough for Judea. But this time, for once, his foul mood was not my fault. It was Petronius, his primus pilus, his senior centurion. Petronius had assigned his unit. to extra duty for the entire Passover season, and they had 3 days to report to the Praetorium in Jerusalem. I tried to look properly sympathetic. But all I could think was Jerusalem. Gratian was going to Jerusalem, where there was always trouble. But during Passover? Passover bread revolts. Judea, Jerusalem. Gratian hated everything about Judea, but especially the Jews. And of all the Jews in the province, he particularly hated the Jews of Jerusalem. And he particularly hated them during their Passover. They were difficult people, hard to govern because they couldn't bear the thought that they were subject to heathen Romans. They refused to worship the emperor. They thought paying taxes to him was blasphemous, because their God was the only ruler of Israel. In Jerusalem, when they paid taxes, they got to use special coins that did not have the likeness of Caesar Augustus. Of all Roman subjects, they were exempt from military service. This galled Gratian more than anything. Although, on the other hand, he always said they would be useless as soldiers. So lazy, the entire lot of them did nothing at all one day a week. Gratian thought the iron boot of Rome tread too lightly on the Jews of Jerusalem. And now he was being sent there. For the entire Passover season, not just a few days, it was 50 days from Passover to Pentecost. 50 days. If I were lucky, I would be free of Gratian for months. And if I were luckier still, he would never come back. Sometimes, even soldiers died in riots. I began to pray to the goddess Spes, goddess of hope. And as week followed week, I dared to hope that she had heard me, because we heard disturbing reports from Jerusalem. Another anti-Roman rebel, another Messiah, had risen up. Some said that the Galilean prophet, the one they called the healer, had entered Jerusalem with thousands of people prepared to put him on the throne. Then we heard news of his arrest and of his execution, followed by rumors that he was not actually dead. But I didn't hear reports, no news of riots, of the deaths of Roman soldiers, as I had hoped. On the 28th day of Maius, all hope ended, as rumor and word spread from the garrison. They were back. Gratian and his soldiers were back, all of them. My chest was so tight with fear I could barely breathe as I waited for my vile husband to come home. But he never came. The man who walked through that door looked like him. He had the right uniform, the same build, the same hair, the same scar on his chin that curved up and nearly touched his lip. But it was not my husband, not the one who had ridden out nearly 10 weeks before. This one was bewitched. You could see it in his eyes, hear it in his voice. He stayed up all night talking about the Galilean, Jesus of Nazareth, the Christ. Most of what we had heard was true, much of it anyway. He had entered Jerusalem in a display worthy of royalty, but he was no rebel. Despite what the Jewish authorities said, he was not trying to be king. He was not trying to set himself up on the throne, not trying to overthrow Rome. He said as much himself, but he said it with such singular dignity and power that Gratian was both moved and unnerved. He ended up turning on the priests and rulers and accusing them of beginning the disturbance. As a group, he always thought that the priests and Pharisees had something of the barbaric about them, something indecent, like a whiff from a slaughterhouse or a latrine. He thought anyone who could disturb that den of thieves couldn't be all bad. But he also had a job to do, and the popularity of Jesus of Nazareth made him a threat not only to the Jewish authorities, but to Rome. So for the rest of the week, wherever the Nazarene went, soldiers and spies went also. Gratian made a point to always know where he was, what he was saying, who he was with. It wasn't difficult. People in Jerusalem were talking of nothing else. He knew about the healings. He knew what he was telling the people, what the authorities were telling him. He heard how he took possession of the temple, how he scattered indignant priests, terrified priests into the streets. He was sorry to have missed that. He also heard of all the plottings, the secret meetings. He knew about the arrest, and it didn't sit well with him. He wasn't convinced that Jesus was guilty, but he was fairly certain his accusers were. Guilty, certainly, of breaking their own laws in their desperate attempt to bring Jesus to justice. Guilty of being dead to pity and shame. He saw it Friday morning when they arrived, waking the prefect shortly after dawn, insisting that he examine the prisoner. Pilatus saw through their scheming. He could tell Jesus had done nothing wrong, so he tried to shift the responsibility to Herod Antipas, who was also in town, and Herod shifted it back. All morning, as he ferried Jesus from palace to palace, Gratian watched. Watched the judges, watched the people, watched the prisoner. He couldn't understand what was happening. He couldn't understand the unreasoning fury of the Jewish leaders. He couldn't understand Pilatus. He had never seen the prefect so anxious to avoid executing someone. Just the year before, he had had no trouble ordering 3,000 Samaritans put to death during a tax revolt, most of them innocent bystanders. But now, he kept trying to appease the Jews, kept trying to offer concessions. Rough them up a little bit, they'll be happy. But they were unreasonable. Finally, they were nearly out of control. He knew that if they really did riot, if they really did start to tear the palace apart, Pilatus would have to answer to his superiors in Rome. So finally, in desperation, Pilatus offered them a choice: Jesus of Nazareth or some thug named Barabbas. A villain if there ever was one, a mangy cur. Gratian knew criminals. He knew what they looked like. And he searched the face of Jesus for any evidence and found none. When he looked, he saw tenderness, calm resignation. But Barabbas? When he heard the decision the people made, he wanted to scream at them. Look at them! Look at their faces! Can you not tell the difference? It takes no great insight to tell what Barabbas is. When they began to scream to crucify Jesus, he felt sick. He couldn't just wash his hands as Pilatus did and pretend he had nothing to do with it. He had to follow orders, didn't he? He was trained to follow orders. And he followed them all the way to the hill named Calvaria. He followed his orders, even as he heard Jesus asking his God to forgive. He followed orders, even as he heard the thief asking to be remembered. Even as he heard the words, "It is finished," spoken like the words of a conqueror. And when that awful blackness descended, when the earth shook and split apart, and terror finally paralyzed the crowd into silence, he heard himself saying, "Surely this was the Son of God." When the darkness lifted, and that crowd, still solemn, still silent now, where earlier they had been screaming for blood, as they made their way back to Jerusalem, there were many in that crowd who were convinced that Jesus had been no pretender. Gratian among them. There were many in that crowd who just hours earlier were yelling, hours earlier were spitting, hours earlier were laughing at that man, who now, through narrowed eyes, looked at their leaders more carefully and began to ask questions. And the priests and rulers found that they dreaded the dead Christ far more than they had ever feared the living Christ. And they went back to Pilatus. They had remembered something that the Nazarene had said, nonsense, of course, something about rising the third day, and they had a small favor to ask, a trifle. 100 soldiers, that was all. 100 soldiers to guard a dead man's tomb. An error on their part, as it turned out. 100 soldiers. That's a lot of witnesses. 100 soldiers. It's hard to guarantee that 100 soldiers will remember to tell the right story, no matter how much you've paid them. 100 soldiers fell asleep. Did anybody in that city believe the story? Did anyone believe that those followers were brave enough? Where were those followers? They had run. They were hiding. And they stole a body from a centurion of Roman soldiers. Ah, but the soldiers were asleep. 100 soldiers were asleep. If they were asleep, how did they know who stole the body? If they were all asleep, how is it that they were all still alive? The punishment, if a soldier is derelict in his duty, is death. And if an entire unit is guilty, they are decimated. 1 out of every 10 is chosen to die, beaten to death by the other 9. Gratian would have known it was a lie, even if he hadn't already heard the truth from those soldiers themselves. They weren't asleep. They were wide awake when they saw that angel. They were wide awake when they saw him move that stone as if it were a pebble. They were wide awake when they saw the Christ, the same one that some of them so very recently had mocked and spit on and tortured. They were wide awake when he walked out of that tomb. And then, only then, to a man did they faint dead away. And when they recovered, They ran like frightened little girls back to Jerusalem, their legs still trembling, telling everyone that they met on the way that the Christ was alive. It was past dawn when Gratian finished his story. By then he had told me everything he had knew, everything he had learned about the God of the Jews and the Son he had sent to us, the one he had crucified, the one who was alive and who had forgiven him. And he sat there in our home and asked me to forgive him. But I couldn't. Did he really think it was that simple? That I was that simple? That in one evening I could forget 23 years of misery? No, he didn't deserve to be forgiven. What kind of God forgets your sins? What kind of God would give Gratian a new life when he deserved to die? I would never forgive him. And I never would have, if it weren't for the butcher. Yes, the butcher, Shemaiah bar Kokhba. The butcher who in Caesarea had a shop. I went to his shop all the time. The front of his shop was the very model of Jewish dietary law, but everyone knew that if your coin was good, you could find eels and suckling pigs in the back. You could probably also find dice games, plenty of wine, and your drunken husband. But Shemaiah had also been in Jerusalem. Shemaiah had seen those same events, had heard the same reports. Shemaiah was there, happily following the crowd. He appreciated the excitement the Nazarene had brought to the city. He saw his friend, Gratian. Thought, oh, we will have stories to share when we get back. Shemaiah knew that was not the Messiah they were crucifying. It couldn't be. He was a nobody. He was not the promised one. He was certain. He just needed to prove it to himself, to quiet the whisperings in his soul. So for the first time since he left his father's house, Shemaiah turned to the holy writings, just wondering. And 50 days later at Pentecost, Shemaiah saw the followers, the disciples of the Nazarene, the ones who had been in hiding. These were not the same men. These were not the same men who had run when their master was arrested. These were not the same men who had not been seen since. These men were preaching boldly, going through the prophecies that Shemaiah himself had been searching, explaining everything to the crowd, and explaining it in a way that made you wonder, were these the fishermen? No. They were different men, and it was a different butcher who returned to Caesarea Maritima. No more dice games. Now, in the evening, he and Gratian pored over the sacred books, Gratian sometimes asking questions faster than Shemaiah could answer them. And there were others. They found, scattered in the city, other people who had been there, other people who had heard. Some were even from the garrison, soldiers. And I think Gratian brought them all home. They were an odd mix. Mostly Jews, some Romans, a few barbarians, but they acted like a single people. They ate together, prayed together, studied together. It was unnatural. Everything about them was unnatural. The way they talked as if their God were actually listening. The way husbands treated their wives as if they were human beings. The way they accepted Gratian. I thought if they knew who he really was, if they knew the things he had done, I began to realize that they did know, it just didn't matter. I resented their happiness. I resented Gratian's happiness. So no matter how hard they tried, I refused to be drawn in. And I was still refusing the night another group had gotten together at our home. I couldn't see who was talking because, as usual, I was sitting well apart from the others. But I didn't need to see. I knew Shemaiah's voice. He was repeating words that the Christ had spoken. If you hold to what I've taught you, if you live it, you will experience the truth. You will be my disciples, and that truth will set you free. Anyone who chooses a life of sin is trapped and is, in fact, a slave. But if the Son sets you free, you shall be free indeed. And I realized Shemaiah was right. He was free. Gratian was free. Everyone in that room was free. I was the only one who was still a slave. I was still chained to the hatred I had for Gratian because he didn't deserve for me to let it go, just like he didn't deserve to be forgiven. He didn't deserve to be free. But he was. Because of Christ, he had forgiveness and freedom anyway. And for the first time, I understood that because of Christ, I could have them too. Isn't it beautiful? It's a gift from Gratian to his new wife, the one who's finally free.